Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Thursday, June 6th. For today's temperature podcast on health and the environment, Michael Booth talks with Jennifer Brown about heart transplants for very young patients and a housing first model that gets the homeless into secure housing. Before we begin, Elevation Music Festival is back. Join us in Alma, Colorado, August 16th to 17th for an unforgettable weekend of top-tier music against stunning mountain vistas. Enjoy world-class performances and immerse yourself in the beauty of the highest incorporated town in North America. Don't miss out. Visit ElevationMusicFest.com for more information. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1904, Western Federation of Miners members dynamited the Independence Depot in Teller County, killing over a dozen replacement workers. This marked a violent peak in a labor strike. The WFM, influential in Colorado's mining industry, had previously secured the 8-hour workday in 1902. However, Governor James Peabody, elected the same year, aimed to curb union power. In 1903, several strikes erupted, leading to violent confrontations. After the Independence attack, the Colorado National Guard arrested over 1,500 suspected militants and evicted 238 from the state. The strike's failure marked the decline of miner participation in the Federation. Before we continue, join the Colorado Sun on June 25th as equity reporter Tatiana Flowers speaks with a panel about how they see mental illness falling through the cracks, what some solutions are or ways to address the issues, and more. The event is free and virtual. RSVP today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Thanks for joining us, everybody, on our Thursday podcast. As always on Thursday, we are talking about the topics in the temperature newsletter, which talks about both health and climate and also where they intersect. John's taking some time off, much needed and much deserved, and the great Jen Brown is helping to fill in with some more of her health reporting. Jen covers mental health, social services, physical health, anything else in Colorado that's of interest, and does a great job. And it's been busy as usual on a couple of different topics this week. So, Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
You have been doing a couple of different stories. The first one that I think people can look forward to seeing next week at coloradosun.com has to do with the very bittersweet topic of childhood transplants, organ transplants at Children's Hospital. And with transplants, especially with heart transplants, in order for them to work out, it means that some other family has had something very bad happen in their family, but with a better ending. And you were able to talk about the context of Children's Hospital and all they've done with transplants. What prompted the story, and then where does Children's fit in the world of childhood transplants?
Well, you're right. It is a bittersweet story. That I heard about this little girl named Willow and her family basically living in Maryland, and her heart is failing from the time she's a five-month-old baby. And the hospitals, the Children's Hospital in D.C., the one in Philadelphia, the one in Boston, they were all saying, no, a heart transplant isn't the best thing for this little child. And the mother, as mothers do, would not give up and started reaching out to other hospitals and ended up hearing back from the head of the heart transplant program at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora, and who said, yeah, I think I would give her a heart transplant. And just based on that, the family sold their house. You know, they've got five boys and this one little girl and moved across the country. They now live in Castle Rock. And when they got here, were able to get on the transplant list. And little Willow has a new heart and is doing great. So a few more things about Children's, though, that I learned talking to this family is that the heart transplant program there it started in the 1980s. It's grown so much over the years that it's now like the fifth most busy in terms of transplanting hearts in the nation. And that means about maybe 20 or so heart transplants every year.
Is that part of what maybe in this case and in some other cases allows them to look at a little girl and say, yeah, we think we can do that. We've got a lot of experience. And with transplants, experience is everything, and repetition is everything. They sound like they're fairly confident in a lot of these cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the other hospitals, of course, that didn't want to do the transplant are huge hospitals as well, you know, but they were advocating for like a surgery on her valve. And Children's mm-hmm. was like, no, I don't think that's the safest thing to do. Like, we would rather try to get her a new transplant and give her a better chance. So the team there is pretty big. They, you know, every time they do a transplant, it takes two surgeons. So I believe they've got four total on the team, because these heart transplant surgeons need to be available, you know, day or night, any day of the week. One of the surgeons will fly to whatever state has the donor. You know, that's the very sad part of the story, and collect the heart and fly it back to Aurora. And then the next surgeon takes over from there. And, you know, the family described, like, you don't really know that it's going to happen. They had false alarms, and, you know, you prepare to pack a bag, and that happened before the time that Willow actually did get the new heart. But you don't know it's going to happen until, as the mom put it, they're like cutting open your kid's chest and the heart is actually there and ready to go.
Wow. Such a powerful thing that can be done. Talking about the other end of it, the donor end, the bittersweet, the good news, bad news is that when a child, a young, very young child, is in a lot of trouble and needs an organ, the supply is even smaller than it might be for adults, just because, you know, American medicine has made it safer to be a child, and you don't end up in that situation as often. So you can be on the waiting list for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the tragic part of it all is that the child who's giving the heart probably died of some accident or, you know, a tragic sudden death in their family. But they said more often than not, family in that situation will donate organs. But, you know, thankfully that doesn't happen very often. And in this case, the donor came from a 2-year-old boy, almost the same age as Willow, lived in New Mexico, who died in an accident. And what was just so touching is that these two moms, you know, have met, they've talked to each other. The family of the little boy came up to Colorado to visit Willow's family. And, you know, something Willow's mom said about that meeting, it was just, you know, anytime you donate an organ, it's a huge thing and a big deal. But the fact that this mother of the little boy could actually hear her son's heart beating in Willow's chest was just, I'm sure, amazing and also terribly sad.
Huh, that's incredible. And you previewed the story that people will see next week with the image of Willow running around the backyard with her brothers, something she couldn't do months ago. And so that's incredible. We'll look forward to seeing that. You've also been doing a lot of reporting in social services, mental health, as you always do. And as everybody in Colorado who has been reading anything in the news or just driving around, walking around their neighborhoods knows, there's a huge need for affordable housing, huge need for housing for the currently homeless. And the programs that you've been writing about are a special kind of housing program. You'll have to tell me the right term for it, but it's almost like no questions asked housing. Housing first, get someone inside the shelter and worry about everything else later. And you've given kind of an update on where those programs are and whether they're building new ones. What's going on in that part of the field?
Yes. So the preferred term is permanent supportive housing. But sure, you're right. It is basically low barrier housing, which means, you know, you don't need to have a job. You don't even need to be sober. You might still be using. You might have severe mental health issues, but still, you're going to get this apartment. And inside the apartment, there's going to be all these services available to you, which are not required, but they're right there. And the goal is that after, you know, someone is housed for whatever amount of time it takes and they get comfortable with that and feel safe, they will take advantage of those services. But I mean, it's a different concept because the goal here is not to say, oh, we're going to train you for a job and then you're going to find your own independent living situation. You know, from the moment they get there, it's just, this is your permanent home if you want to stay here until you die, you know? So there's two new projects that are coming up. One is opening next week, and it's a project from the Jefferson Center for Mental Health. It's called Solid Ground Apartments in Lakewood. And this is 40 people moving in that will come, you know, most of them straight from the street or a shelter into their own place. And then Denver's Mental Health Center called WellPower has already started building a very similar apartment kind of on the border of Lakewood and Denver over by the Sheridan Light Rail Station. That one will have 60 people moving in when it opens in the spring.
And they're modeled somewhat after a program that started, I think you mentioned 2017, some housing that opened that was a result of some private investors, nonprofit investors, some foundations, putting money into a concept, this concept, with the idea that whoever builds it and puts up the money might get some of that money back by all the services that won't be used, all the things that a city won't and society won't have to pay for. If someone's not going to detox or not going to the ER or not going into a psychiatric hospital and not getting police responses. And so it saves money and that can somehow help pay for the new housing.
Yeah, that's exactly the concept. And it was 2017 when Sanderson Apartments, it's called, opened. And that place still has a waiting list. It was a national model when it opened. For the concept you just described, you know, private investors gave the city money and the, you know, mental health center and the Coalition for the Homeless filled it up with people. And they literally went around the city with a list of names of people who had been in the ER constantly or had been in detox or were always arrested. And they would like go find them out in the field where they lived behind 7-Eleven and be like, hey, we want you to live in this apartment. And, you know, it was studied extensively and, you know, they did find out like, you know, probably around a 50% reduction in, you know, going to hospitals and much like a 65% decrease in detox. It was a lot of savings, like millions of dollars in savings in terms of these city services. So, and the other cool thing about this building, which made it a national model and now is being copied, you know, twice in Denver, is that it's what they call like a trauma-informed building design. And it's really just made for people who are used to sleeping outside, like people who are used to sleeping without walls and with the sun coming up in their face is how they described it. There's no scary dark corners. You know, the laundry room in Solid Ground is purposely in the corner of a building. So it has two windows that face outdoors, two walls and windows. And this is because people who've spent time on the streets, the laundromat is a pretty traumatic place because, you know, while they've been doing their laundry, their tent or their cart of belongings was stolen or they were assaulted in a laundromat or gotten an altercation with people, you know, trying to share machines. And so it's things like that in the building. One other, you know, tidbit I thought was super interesting is they purposely made the beds in these apartments instead of within wooden slats under the mattress. It's just like a full wooden platform. And that's for people who aren't used to sleeping on a mattress. So they can take it off and they can lay still above, like off the ground, but on a hard surface because, you know, they've been used to sleeping on a sidewalk.
Amazing. How much thought and hard work and money and research goes into these places. So thanks for bringing that to us. People should go to coloradosun.com to see that story already published. And again, Jen's story about heart transplants in Colorado and what's happened to a couple of families who have a new intimate and bittersweet connection over a child's heart will be in next week's Colorado Sun. Thanks a lot, Jen. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good day.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. If you are one of the millions of visitors planning to head to Estes Park and Rocky Mountain National Park this summer, there are a few things to know before you go. The biggest is that the road through downtown remains under construction as they build a one-way loop in and out of town for those headed to the national park. Most business owners welcome the change, but before it's done, there's still a lot of disruption ahead. As well, inside the national park, the main campground remains closed for renovations, and there isn't an opening date set yet. Since 2021, Colorado has ranked among the top 5 states with the most suspicious activity reports issued by money services businesses for suspected money laundering. According to a report from last year, money services businesses flagged more than 22,000 transactions in Colorado they suspected were intended to convert money from crimes into usable cash. That's a 40% increase from the previous year. The increase comes as federal authorities are eyeing the role money services businesses play in allowing fentanyl dealers, many associated with cartels in Mexico, to illegally send profits back home in hard-to-trace transactions. 1 year after the Supreme Court removed federal regulations protecting wetlands and streams from development pressures, Colorado is the first state to pass legislation replacing those regulations. According to a national report, 8 other states have taken action to restore some level of protection or are trying. 5 launched failed attempts to impose further cutbacks, and Indiana became the only state to cut protections further. 35 states have taken no action. Environmentalists say the spotty response is an indication that Congress must intervene to create clearly defined protections that work for all states and protect rivers and wetlands that cross state boundaries. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. My name is Jason Blevins. I'm the outdoors writer here at the Colorado Sun, co-founder of the Colorado Sun. I'm on the weekly podcast with David Krause every Monday, and I also write a weekly newsletter. Comes out every Thursday. It's called The Outsider. Take a look at each issue has sort of early glimpses of stories. I got stuff on housing, high country business, high country culture, public lands, public land managers, kind of just about anything kind of interesting and happening on the Western Slope. Try to get into it. Ski industry stuff. I invite you to come check it out. It's one of the many newsletters we have at the Colorado Sun. Head to coloradosun.com/join and become a member and support the Colorado Sun. Appreciate you guys listening. Thanks.